This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, August the 11th, 2026. As always, we're going to start in the world section and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to start us off from the world section, our first headline reads, "With Mideast still at war, three regional powers ink a new alliance." The Saudi-Turkish-Pakistani compact is a response to the prolonged Iran war, an Israel perceived as seeking hegemony, and the failure of other diplomatic initiatives. It also anticipates a reduced U.S. regional posture. Does that help the United States? The date on this article is August the 11th. It is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and the dateline is Amman, Jordan. As the U.S.-Iran war grinds to a stalemate, a new alliance is emerging in and around the Middle East. Accelerated by the conflict, but not party to it, this new bloc says it aims to bring stability to a region at war. The new defense and security alliance between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Pakistan was cemented Friday in Mecca, one of Islam's holiest cities. The so-called Mecca Joint Defense Agreement includes a NATO member, a nuclear power, and the world's largest exporter of oil, and a leader of the Muslim world. It declares an attack on one as an attack on all, though at least one prominent analyst says the initiative calls the initiative more symbolic than practical. The Mecca Pact might not lead to a new front being opened against Iran, but observers and officials say it signals a deep shift in a region confronting shared threats and preparing for waning U.S. influence in the Middle East. The agreement declares that, quote, any armed attack against any one of the three states shall be regarded as an attack against them all, end quote, underlining security cooperation to act as a deterrence against any act of aggression. In an interview on Turkish television on Saturday, Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan said the agreement is technically similar to NATO's Article 5 on collective defense, but the joint actions would depend on a request made by a member state. Under the terms of the pact, if one member is attacked, the alliance would provide intelligence, logistical support, and munitions, and consider the deployment of military units depending on the threat level, according to Mr. Fidan. The alliance, which straddles Europe, the Persian Gulf, and Iran's eastern and western borders, was formed, multiple Gulf officials say, after efforts to unite Gulf Arab states had, until then, failed due to internal divisions, despite the shared threat from Iran and its proxies. Under the agreement, Saudi Arabia is to import Turkish and Pakistani technology and manufacturing know-how to build up its domestic defense industry, with Saudi Arabia expected to ramp up its production of drones, interceptors, and missiles, say Saudi officials and observers who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters. Turkey and Pakistan, in return, will receive injections of cash for arms purchases. The three are to act as a collective diplomatic bloc, combining their middle power statuses on the world stage. For Riyadh, creation of the bloc aims to change the calculus of any group considering strikes against Saudi infrastructure or territory. The pact was signed as Iran and its proxies increased their attacks against Saudi energy infrastructure, striking Saudi Aramco oil facilities on the kingdom's Red Sea and Persian Gulf coasts. Since the signing of the pact on Friday, Saudi, Turkish, and Pakistani officials have gone to great lengths to stress that the alliance is not against one country, nor is it inherently antagonistic toward Iran. But the alliance is meant to protect against the expansionist aims and destabilizing activities of any regional power, particularly Iran and Israel. Iran and its axis of resistance proxies have actively worked to collapse Arab states. In 2015, Iran boasted of having control over four Arab capitals in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen. Tehran has recently targeted Gulf Arab states' airports, economies, and residential areas in retaliation for the United States and Israel's military offensive, and by closing or endangering shared waterways and export routes, is threatening to plunge the region's economy into a deep recession. The new bloc also rejects what its three members see as Israel's attempting to establish regional primacy through military force, demanding the freedom to act against perceived threats anywhere, normalizing ties with Arab states on its terms, and extending its occupied border buffer zone in Syria and Lebanon. Gulf states and Turkey have deemed these actions destabilizing to the region and their interests. Experts say that the PAC's version of NATO's Article 5 is more aspirational than practical, but it is clear in setting out a new way in the Middle East. I don't think Turkey will be striking Iran if Iran hits Saudi Arabia tomorrow, and I just don't see Turkey hitting India if Pakistan is attacked, says H.A. Hellyer, a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London and the Center for American Progress in Washington. I think this agreement was very symbolic. But I do think it sends a very significant political message to the Iranians and to the Israelis that, quote, we are not interested in your projects in this region, Dr. Hellyer says, and that we have other better ways we think that will be much more attractive to the vast majority of countries in the region. It is also described as Riyadh's rebuttal to the Abraham Accords, which normalized diplomatic ties between Israel and Arab states, but which Saudi saw as ignoring their security concerns. For Riyadh, this alliance is about boosting Saudi Arabia's defense capacity, increasing its deterrence, and creating a diplomatic bloc that will delegitimize any spoiling actions in the region, says Saudi geopolitical analyst Aziz Al-Ghashian. This is not an anti-Iran or an anti-Israel alliance, but Iran and Israel have a choice whether they want to be a spoiler or not. The organic formation of the security bloc is also seen as preparation for a reduced U.S. footprint in the region. Gulf officials take note of the rising support among both Democrats and Republicans to redirect American military and economic support for the Middle East back home stateside. This trilateral alliance is saying, we still would like to work with the U.S. The U.S. is still undoubtedly the main security provider, but we will have to work with others and take security into our own hands more, says Mr. Al-Ghashian. Having three major regional U.S. allies iron out their differences and form a security arrangement that is not 100% reliant on an overstretched United States, but still coordinating with Washington, is good for American interests in the region, he adds. We could be talking about the seeds of something that does not come into effect for many years, Dr. Hellyer says, but at the very least, it is a very strong political message. And once again, this particular article was written by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Moving right on to our second article from today's World section of The Monitor, the headline reads, In Pakistan, internal unrest reveals limits of military power. Recent violence in various corners of Pakistan, from a Swat Valley suicide bomb attack to unrest in Kashmir, can be traced back to weak civilian governance. The date on this article is August the 10th. It is by Hassan Ali, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is Islamabad. Pakistan is a nuclear-armed state run by a powerful military establishment. Other nations rely on Islamabad's military prowess to maintain regional stability. But within its own borders, the state is struggling to contain a broad range of security risks. Voters faced heightened security restrictions during the final phase of fraud elections in Pakistan-administered Kashmir on Monday after violent protest, an internet blackout, and calls for an election boycott disrupted polling. And just last week, a suicide bomb killed at least 17 people and injured dozens more outside a police station in Pakistan's Swat Valley. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, which came amid a continuing separatist insurgency in the province of Balochistan. Under the leadership of Field Marshal Asim Munir, Pakistan's military has become more involved in general governance and embraced a hardline approach to terrorism, but the security situation has only deteriorated. This year, Pakistan climbed to number one on the Global Terrorism Index, which measures the impact of terrorism across 163 countries. The recent wave of violence highlights the limits of military might, observers say, and the need for political solutions. There are lots of things that cannot be solved with guns, says Farzana Ali, who covers the Swat Valley as Peshawar bureau chief for the Pakistani network Aaj News. Until you allow political people to come forward, you will never fix the issue of instability. Once a popular tourist destination, the Swat Valley in the northern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa became a major battleground between 2007 and 2009. That's when the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, TTP, began to expand its control over the region. Through a major military operation in 2009, the Pakistani army was able to reestablish control, but the valley has continued to experience intermittent terrorist attacks in the years since. After hearing about last week's attack, local peace activist Saad Khan rushed to Seydou Teaching Hospital to show solidarity with the victims. This suicide blast has naturally created deep anxiety and fear in the public, he says. The people of Swat have faced this kind of thing before. We do not want to see our families go through those dark days again. Analysts say Pakistani security troubles in this valley and beyond stem in part from a chronic lack of political representation. Military dictators have directly ruled Pakistan for nearly half of the country's history. For the rest, the military has influenced governments from the shadows, propping up civilian governments and tearing them down as needed. Power is concentrated in the hands of the army chief, who crafts critical security policies, including on counterterrorism, behind closed doors. During the tenure of former military leader Qamar Javed Bajwa, Pakistan embarked on the controversial policy of repatriating Pakistani Taliban fighters from neighboring Afghanistan and allowing them to settle in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Supporters of the plan argued that it would persuade these fighters to lay down arms and reintegrate into society. Instead, it allowed the TTP to regroup. When Field Marshal Munir replaced General Bajwa in late 2022, this policy of repatriotism was suddenly reversed. Negotiations with the TTP ended, counterterrorism operations resumed, and the government launched a mass deportation drive of Afghan refugees, citing an uptick in terrorism activity. Experts criticize both approaches but say the transition was destabilizing. For any policy to be successful, it needs to be consistent, says Ms. Ali. For 2 years, we were talking about resettling and neutralizing these fighters. Then we suddenly decided we needed to crush them. How can such policymaking ever be effective? The current government's effectiveness is also hindered by its lack of public legitimacy. Wednesday marks 3 years since Pakistan's most popular politician, Imran Khan, was jailed on various charges after his relations with the military publicly broke down. Following a 2024 general election marred by allegations of widespread vote rigging, the government, led by Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, has struggled to build momentum. This has forced the military to take an even bigger role in day-to-day governance. The result, say experts, is that the military establishment is stretched too thin. It does not have the bandwidth to properly address the multiple crises unfolding in Pakistan's provinces. They point to the state's violent clampdown on protest in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. In June, an unofficial delegation of senior political leaders tried to visit the region to hear protesters' concerns, but was stopped en route by security forces. Human rights groups have also criticized Islamabad's use of anti-terrorism laws to jail political activists speaking out about Balochistan, the country's most volatile province. And just last week, Islamabad announced new guidelines that restrict foreign media's ability to report on these sensitive regions. The unrest in these provinces is rooted in economic hardship and feelings of disenfranchisement. But, quote, we are not dealing with these issues when they are political issues, says Pakistani opposition politician Taimur Khan Shagra. And as the military adopts an increasingly hardline approach to unrest, he says it's backing the government into a corner. The space for political solutions based on dialogue, negotiation, and compromise is shrinking. And again, this particular article is by Hassan Ali, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Continuing from the world section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, Cyprus natural gas will help supply Europe by first half of 2028, officials say. The East Mediterranean is becoming an alternative energy source for Europe as Russia's war in Ukraine and Middle East upheaval pushes Europe to find new sources. The date on this article is August the 9th. It is by Menelaos Hadjikostas of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Nicosia, Cyprus. European consumers can expect natural gas from an undersea deposit off Cyprus to help meet their energy needs as early as March 2028, the island's national energy minister said. Michael Damianos says the eastern Mediterranean is fast becoming an alternative energy source for European nations as Russia's war in Ukraine and upheaval in the Middle East compel the continent to seek out new sources. Mr. Damianos says partners Total Energies of France and Italy's Eni made a final decision last month to proceed with developing the Kronos natural gas field off Cyprus' southern coast. The project will be the first time gas from eastern Mediterranean deposits is supplied to European markets. It's important for Europe at this time because of the war in Ukraine, because of this situation in the Middle East, that Cyprus is going to be an alternative source of gas, Mr. Damianos told the Associated Press in an exclusive interview Friday. According to the Eni Total Energies Consortium timetable, work on a pipeline from Kronos to existing infrastructure at Egypt's massive Zohr natural gas deposit, 105 kilometers or 65 miles away, will begin later this year and take up to 18 months to complete. Once that's done, the gas will be conveyed to the Damietta processing facility on Egypt's northern shore, where it will be liquefied for transport by ship to Europe. Piping Kronos gas to Egypt for processing was the most economically viable option, costing roughly $2 billion, or 1.73 billion euros, or half the estimated cost of developing other gas fields inside Cypriot waters because of its proximity to existing infrastructure. Although the agreement is for all of the more than 3 trillion cubic feet of gas in Kronos to go to Europe, there's a clause in the deal so that about a fifth of that amount could be used to cover some of Egypt's domestic energy needs. It's a small reserve, says Mr. Damianos. Our income as a country is not going to be huge, so its importance is not money. Its importance is the commencement of being a producer and having first gas. Kronos is one of 6 natural gas deposits discovered so far inside Cyprus' exclusive economic zone off its southern coastline. 2 of those, Glaucus and Pegasus, jointly hold an estimated 6.9 trillion cubic feet. ExxonMobil and partner Qatar Energy, which were licensed to develop those fields, said that they expect gas from Glaucus and Pegasus to start flowing by 2033. What we can say is that Exxon is the type of company that sticks by the timelines and sometimes delivers even earlier, Mr. Damianos said. The energy minister said ExxonMobil plans to expand its exploration activities off Cyprus and is expected to receive an additional license to search for hydrocarbons. Another gas field, the first to be found off Cyprus some 15 years ago, is Aphrodite, which holds an estimated 5.6 trillion cubic feet. Mr. Damianos said a final decision by a Chevron-led joint venture to develop the field is expected in the summer of 2027. A pipeline would link the deposit directly to Egyptian facilities to supply the country's domestic energy needs, according to an agreement with Chevron. Part of the Aphrodite field is in Israeli waters, and it's hoped that an arbitrator will decide the percentage Israel is entitled to by next month. Mr. Damianos also hailed the entry of French investment company Meridiam as a backer to the Great Seas Interconnector Project, an electricity cable that will connect Europe's power grid with that of Cyprus and eventually Israel. The ambitious project would not only end Cyprus and Israel's energy isolation, but it would be an important building block for the IMEC initiative, a new energy and trade route to the Gulf and India that the European Union is pursuing. But the project is now tied up in red tape over its real cost above an earlier estimate of £2.2 billion. A European investment bank report that's due in the next few months will offer clarity over its cost. That's important for Cyprus because under an existing agreement, Cypriot energy consumers will have to put up as much as 63% of the cable's construction cost, meaning a significant jump in electricity prices. Additional private investment is being courted to offset that burden on Cypriot consumers, while additional EU funding is being weighed, says Mr. Damianos. The EU has already committed $760 million, or 658 million euros, for the project. It's a very important project for Europe because it connects Cyprus, which is isolated, to the European grid. And the idea is to then proceed and connect to Israel, Mr. Damianos said. And again, this particular article was by Menelaos Hadjikostas of the Associated Press. And here is a final article from today's World section. The headline reads, Brazil's economy is growing under Lula. Why don't voters feel it? President Lula is running for a fourth term in October, but his legacy of poverty alleviation in the early 2000s may be working against him today, with economic expectations high. The date on this article is August the 7th. It is by Constance Mallaret, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is Rio de Janeiro. In Brazil, no barbecue is complete without a top sirloin steak, known as picanha. But these days, the premium cut of beef doesn't just signal a communal meal. It has become shorthand for President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's pledge to raise living standards after getting elected in 2022. It was a promise many believed in, looking back at his first two terms in office between 2003 and 2010, when his policies helped slash poverty by half. But as the politician known as Lula prepares to seek a historic fourth presidential term in October, his poverty reduction track record may be working against him. Lula is struggling to live up to public expectations. Many Brazilians are feeling poorer, not richer, despite the economy growing, albeit slowly at 2.3% last year, according to the National Statistics Institute. The iconic picanha remains a luxury few can afford, with its price jumping nearly 11% this year alone, well above inflation. Lula needs the boost that comes with a feel-good economic sentiment to cement his small lead over his main adversary, Flavio Bolsonaro. Senator Bolsonaro is standing in for his father, former President Jair Bolsonaro, who can't run due to a 27-year jail sentence for an attempted coup, which he's serving under house arrest. The economy is often central to how Brazilians vote, but the South American nation's relatively stable economic situation hasn't translated into a head start for Lula's reelection, says Tiago Oliveira, an economics professor at the Federal Fluminense University in Rio de Janeiro State. That may have more to do with political polarization as well as the sky-high citizen expectations for the economy on the heels of two decades of social mobility, experts say. Unemployment has dropped to record lows over the past 4 years in Brazil, and poverty and hunger have receded. Yet, in one recent poll, 53% of Brazilians said the economy was bad and 44% said it was worse now under Lula than it had been during Jair Bolsonaro's presidency. Take Bruno Meirelles, who helps run his stepmother's stall selling soccer jerseys and Brazil-branded knickknacks in a downtown Rio de Janeiro shopping district. Even though the last administration was during a pandemic, things like purchasing power were better. Nowadays, it's gotten a lot harder, he says, pointing to the cost of food in particular. A carton of eggs that used to cost around 10 reales, or $1.94, now doesn't go for anything less than 18 reales, $3.50, he said. When Lula returned to the presidency in 2023, he focused on reprising the social policies that carried millions out of poverty during his first two terms, such as his flagship conditional cash transfer program, Bolsa Família. His government also pushed through a long-awaited tax reform designed to make Brazil's tax system fairer. It raised the threshold for income tax exemptions for 10 million low earners while increasing the tax rate for the very wealthy. But unlike in the 2000s, it has not been a government marked by innovations, by the launch of great programs, says Marta Areche, a professor of political science at the University of São Paulo. Lula's Workers' Party, PT, comes and goes, but nothing changes much, says Angelica Pinheiro, a restaurant worker. The PT has held power for 18 of the past 24 years. Ms. Pinheiro says she plans to vote for Flavio Bolsonaro in October. A regular part of Senator Bolsonaro's messaging on the economy involves videos of him walking around supermarkets, balking at prices, and drawing comparisons with costs during his father's presidency. People remember the price of picanha from 5 years ago, says Dr. Oliveira. Lula promised cheaper picanha, and that's not been the case. Brazilians' expectations have also shifted after two decades of consumer-driven social mobility and with the advent of platforms like Instagram and TikTok. Social media creates consumption aspirations for a large part of the Brazilian population that are clearly incompatible with their income levels, says Dr. Oliveira, who is also a researcher at the Inter-University Center for Studies on Inequality and Development. It's a global phenomenon, but something that's accented here by the country's deep inequality, he says. And in Brazil, this discrepancy between income and aspirations has contributed to record levels of debt. Today, 8 in every 10 Brazilians are in some kind of debt, according to the National Trade Confederation. We need to eat, buy diapers, so all our money goes to paying it off and using it. There's never anything left over, says Graziella de Moura, a young mother in Brasilia, the capital, who first went into debt when she was 18 years old. Credit cards, she says, opened up a life of luxury she'd never previously experienced. She bought McDonald's meals, cinema outings, and new clothes, and was only able to climb out of debt by scrimping on rent and working long hours. But after getting pregnant, a series of unexpected charges on credit put Ms. Demura in the red again. She's not eligible for a debt relief program launched by Lula's government in May, one of a series of measures looking to stimulate consumer spending and boost the economy. Lula has held a small lead over Senator Bolsonaro in the polls since May. The senator's ratings took a hit after revelations that he approached a banker at the center of a fraud scandal to finance a biopic about the elder Mr. Bolsonaro. In Brasilia's polarized political climate, anything Lula offers may be less of a difference, may make less of a difference than they would have in the past, says Dr. Areche. Around a third of the electorate will never approve of anything Lula does, she says, for the simple reason that they solidly support the Bolsonaro family. And once again, this particular article was by Constant Malloret, who is a contributor at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline reads, in the U.S., civic participation is changing. What does that mean for communities? The way Americans engage with civic life in their communities is changing, presenting challenges to places across America. The date on this article is August the 10th. It is by Scott Baldoff, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. During working hours, Nicola Garderi is an educator in the public school system of her Central Texas town. But at 5 p.m., she heads home, jumps on a Zoom call, and her volunteer work begins. As a founding board member of the Central Texas Area Alliance for Black School Educators, she helps create learning environments where students, particularly black students, can thrive. As chief executive officer of the Myers-Gardner International Foundation, she supports Texas families with education and nutrition needs. As executive board member of the Intelligent and Talented Girls branch in Killeen, Texas, she organizes activities to help every girl find their voice, value, and vision for the future. Why does she do all this? The short answer is that she always has. Her grandmother founded a church. We grew up serving in the church. We had to clean the church, go to the church, close the doors of the church, clean the benches, and then we traveled with her to the two different conventions. The health of America's communities has long depended on volunteers like Ms. Gardner. In his 1835 book, Democracy in America, the French sociologist Alexis de Tocqueville observed that participation in associations made citizens better collaborators and leaders. The only way opinions and ideas can be renewed, hearts enlarged, and human minds developed is through the reciprocal influence of men upon each other. A recent Pew Research Center study shows Americans' spirit of engagement continues, though it faces severe challenges such as declines in religious attendance, civic group membership, and attention to news. But the survey also offers windows into the changing and fractured ways in which Americans still participate in civic life. There's a whole bunch of different ways people can engage, says Elisa Scherer, a senior researcher at Pew Research Center. It shows an America both engaged and disengaged, divided by politics but united in habits. Both Republicans and Democrats can be found at weekend car wash fundraisers or local public library potlucks, and members of both parties say they are exhausted by politics and too busy with multiple jobs to volunteer. Technology can make Americans better informed about current events, but it also made youth more jaded and protective of their privacy. The ramifications for American democracy are uncertain, but potentially transformative. The study found 1 in 10 Americans are the most highly engaged across civic activities, including politics. About 1 in 4 are active in civic life, but not as active politically. About 31% participate less overall, but follow news, and the same percentage reports low participation in most civic activities. Ms. Scherer noted that age was also a big factor in how people engage. Young people, particularly Generation Z, are more likely to follow the news closely, but less likely to volunteer. Older people are most likely to volunteer time for charities, churches, and schools. Young people might tend to chat privately about the news with friends rather than posting on Facebook, but that doesn't mean they're disengaged. The survey showed that among people who participate less in some ways, 49% voted in 2024. That's not huge, but it's not nothing, right? Ms. Scherer says. Sarah Suzuki, a senior researcher at Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, says that young people are hardwired to find a, quote, civic home where they can connect with others, forming their political voices around similar issues and challenges. But for Generation Z, ages 14 to 29, many of whom came of age during the COVID-19 pandemic, finding one civic home has been difficult. The word social media to me is a misnomer because we know that young people have a crisis of loneliness, a crisis of social disconnection, Ms. Suzuki says. She says if young people have this investment in our political life and if they find somewhere where they belong, somewhere where that attention can be translated into action, I think that would be really powerful. Another challenge that pushes people to the margins of engagement is the polarization of discussion of public topics, says Joseph Kahn, director of the Civic Engagement Research Group at the University of California, Riverside. Political parties and conflict entrepreneurs use fear and misinformation to distract people from productive deliberation and action, Professor Kahn says. There is a hunger for a less polarized world, he adds. That doesn't always mean people are willing to moderate on particular positions that are very important to them, Professor Khan says. But when his research team created forums with discussion topics framed in ways that allowed for respectful discourse, people talked productively with one another about potentially controversial issues, and they reported that they appreciated the opportunity. This skill is necessary for a functioning democracy, he says. You can still have strong opinions, but you probably should be interested in what those who disagree with you believe, he says. How can we, as a society, come together to experiment with things, to move forward, to find places where we do agree? For Nate Reeves, a rising senior in Georgetown, Kentucky, volunteering as a student policy coordinator for the local chapter of the nonpartisan Kentucky Students' Voice Team, KSVT, has been the highlight of my high school career. In addition to organizing public meetings to discuss student concerns in the Scott County school system, Mr. Reeves spends 5 to 10 hours a week helping with a KSVT lawsuit against the state. The suit seeks to compel Kentucky to fulfill its legal obligation to provide equal educational opportunities for all communities, as required by a 1989 Kentucky Supreme Court decision. For me, my why is that the students in Scott County are inequitable, and tons of students would like to be involved in solving that problem, but they don't know what to do, Mr. Reeves says. If we give students the ability to be involved, they will be involved. The key is making sure the avenues are as open as possible. Grady Amick is a high school senior from Louisville and a writer for KSVT's student-run newsroom, New Edu. He says that students in his generation have a natural hunger for connection and for meaning, but too often technology gets in the way. Students show up to school suffering from dopamine withdrawal because of the social media, but eventually people want to connect with each other and learn as humans, Mr. Amick says. They're social beings, he adds, and once you can get people to understand that, you can get them to become connected to their communities. In Memphis, Tennessee, Darius Ford, a millennial and a local program director for youth advocate programs, says he and his wife volunteer once a week at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. They also devote time to Micah's Walk for Autism, which supports families affected by autism. I try to make sure that I and my family will be there with bells on, Mr. Ford says. A lot of kids need some type of human interaction and physical activity. It makes them feel important when they know someone is there to see them. In Killeen, Texas, Ms. Gardier says she has seen a decline in young people's active participation in community projects. The solution, she believes, is for adult leaders to intentionally create ways for young people to engage in meaningful work. Ms. Gardier brings her 11-year-old granddaughter along during summer break to serve as her assistant when she gives presentations. She says she can see her granddaughter mouthing the words from her script as she speaks. If something were to happen to me during a session, she could finish it, she says. The next generation needs to be involved early so that engagement becomes a habit, she says. If we don't intentionally develop the next generation of volunteers and community leaders, we risk creating a society of spectators, she says. Engagement is a skill, and like any skill, it must be taught, practiced, and reinforced over time. And once again, this particular article was by Scott Baldoff, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And still from the USA section, here's an article with a local connection. The headline reads, "Still Separate and Unequal? Families Sue Massachusetts Over School Segregation." 70 years after Brown versus Board of Education, students in the Bay State are suing. They say they face segregated school districts with fewer resources, including weaker curriculum and less experienced teachers. The date on this article is August the 10th. It is by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Boston. 50 years ago, Massachusetts became a national test case for equality in schools after riots erupted over policies meant to undo decades of harmful segregation. Courts had ordered the state to bus students across Boston neighborhoods to integrate schools. While the policy remained fraught, by the middle 1980s, a federal appeals court proclaimed schools here as desegregated as was reasonably possible. Today, Massachusetts ranks among the best states in the country for public education. Boston switched to a home-based model in 2014 that claimed to give all families access to high-performing schools without the commute. Even as student test scores have plunged nationwide, public schools in the state continue to make top grades in math and reading. But a lawsuit filed in May says the challenge of segregation is not over. Nine students, represented by their guardians, along with four nonprofit groups, have sued Massachusetts, saying the Commonwealth has denied school children the right to an adequate education and to equal protection under the law. They argue that the state maintains racially segregated school districts characterized by concentrated policy that deny black and Latino students an adequate and equal education and undermine the state's civic and economic future. And they demand a fix to what the lawsuit calls a two-tiered system that has enormous negative consequences. The case reflects challenges that go well beyond the Bay State. More than 70 years after Brown versus Board of Education, when the Supreme Court ruled that separating students on the basis of race is unconstitutional, large school districts across the country are segregated by both race and economics. In 2024, researchers at Stanford University and the University of Southern California found that segregation between white and black students in the country's 100 largest school districts had risen 64% since 1988. Segregation by economic status has also increased by about 50% since 1991, they discovered. At the same time, most school districts in the country are far less segregated than they were 60 years ago, researchers found. More than one-third of the students attended a school where over 75% of the student body was one race or ethnicity during the 2021-2022 school year, according to the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Policymakers, educators, and families recognize the achievement gaps often parallel these economic and racial data. Separate lawsuits from Minnesota and New Jersey filed in 2015 and 2018, respectively, remain ongoing. In Massachusetts, a 2024 report from the state's Racial Imbalance Advisory Council, RIAC, classified 63% of public schools here as either segregated or intensely segregated, which they defined as 71% white or non-white or 90% white or non-white. Intensely segregated white schools average a 66.3 performance score on state accountability data compared with just 18.7% for intensely segregated non-white schools. High school graduation rates were 93% at nearly all white schools versus 72% at schools where children of color make up more than 90% of the student body, according to the council. If you're a black or Latino student who comes from a low-income or underpaid family, your educational prospects, before you have even begun, are severely limited, says Raul Fernandez, a senior lecturer at Boston University's Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Across the country, students are assigned to schools largely based upon where the child's family lives. Because public schools are predominantly funded by property taxes and state money, in general, lower-income communities have schools with less money. And because lower-income areas are disproportionately black and Latino, this means that children of color have a disproportionate likelihood of an under-resourced education. Massachusetts policymakers have tried in myriad ways to address what they agree is a problem. Since 2019, the state has funneled more than $1 billion into public schools through the Student Opportunity Act, which aimed to increase aid to districts with the highest needs. The state has also created programs to address gaps in graduation rates, diversify the public school workforce, and reduce dropout rates and absenteeism. All students, no matter their income level, race, ethnicity, language, or disability, deserve schools where they are known, valued, and have the support they need to succeed. Jacqueline Reyes, a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, the state agency overseeing K-12 learning, wrote in a statement. But the department also says it lacks authority to change school district boundaries or to force students to enroll in other districts. State law gives students the right to attend public school in the town where they reside, free of charge. At the same time, schools generally do not have to accept students who live outside the town's district. In most cases, school district boundaries mirror municipal borders. A resident of Boston, for example, has a legal right to attend schools in Boston, but not in a neighboring city such as Cambridge. And across municipal borders, the quality of curricula can vary widely. In Brockton, for instance, a school district near Boston where 83% of students are black or Latino, about 42% of 11th and 12th grade students complete an advanced course. In bordering Easton, where 72% of students are white, the share that completes advanced coursework is 70%, according to state data. You can throw funding at these schools in separate settings, but really being able to address the integration issue to desegregate these schools is really what helps move the ball forward, says Andrea Watson, an attorney for the nonprofit Brown's Promise, which filed the lawsuit with Lawyers for Civil Rights. But not all education experts agree. Charles Glenn, a professor emeritus at Boston University's Wheelock College, sees no reason that schools serving mostly black or Latino students can't provide a quality education. I'm not knocking desegregation. I think desegregation is important for societal reasons, says Dr. Glenn, who spent two decades as director of urban education and equity efforts for the state's education department. That said, I think we too easily insist that unless we can put black kids in schools with white kids, we can't provide top-rate education for them. I would urge those who are concerned about real opportunity for black and Latino kids to focus on making schools more effective, he adds. Scholars have long criticized the country's reliance on property taxes to fund schools. Property taxes accounted for 52% of public school funding in Massachusetts during the 2021-22 school year, according to federal data, making the state's schools some of the most property tax-reliant in the country. Even if low-income areas had higher taxes, by sheer nature of lower property tax wealth, you're not going to garner as much local revenue, says Erica Weathers, who studies educational equity at University of Pennsylvania. The Massachusetts plaintiffs proposed some solutions, including establishing cross-district magnet schools and expanding existing programs such as the Metropolitan Council for Educational Opportunity. Founded in 1966 to reduce school segregation in Boston, Metco buses students from the urban cities of Boston and Springfield to nearby suburban districts. But it currently serves only 0.35% of public school students, according to the law school. Dr. Fernandez says that regardless of how Massachusetts addresses segregation, it must recognize its responsibility to the children who live here. We need the state to step in and make what I call generational investments in these communities, he says. These are the Commonwealth's kids. We're responsible for all of them. And again, this particular article was by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to jump to the environment section of today's Monitor and pick up a headline or two. The first one reads, rare, quote, super El Nino spikes ocean temps to new record. Ocean surface temperatures hit record highs this July as a rare super El Nino upends air and ocean temperatures around the globe. The date on this is August the 10th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Ocean surface temperatures in July were the hottest ever recorded, the European Union's Copernicus Climate Monitoring Service announced Monday. Monitoring stations in the non-polar ocean captured an average temperature of 20.96 degrees Celsius or 69.73 degrees Fahrenheit. It surpasses the record set in 2023. This monthly ocean temperature record is just one of many weather anomalies that the world will see this year, say climate scientists, as a rare super El Nino upends air and ocean temperatures around the globe. El Niños are natural climate phenomena that occur every 2 to 7 years when the normally predictable trade winds that blow east to west over the equator slow down. These winds typically push warm surface water with them to the western Pacific Ocean around Asia and Australia, which then allows colder, deeper water to rise to the surface in the eastern Pacific around the Americas. But when the winds slow down, the warm water that's typically pushed west can slide back east, spreading the warm water across a greater share of the ocean. Scientists say climate change has been increasing the world's ocean temperatures over the past few decades. While there is a scientific debate about how global warming affects the strength or frequency of El Niños themselves, researchers generally agree that these events are taking place on a baseline affected by climate change, warmer oceans, an atmosphere that is hotter, and, depending on the place, either increased drought or increased atmospheric moisture. This July also tied with 2024 for the second warmest air temps, according to the European Union's Copernicus, behind the record set in 2023. In the United States, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, declares it a Niño year when surface temps in the central and eastern tropical Pacific Ocean warm 0.5 degrees Celsius or 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. According to the NOAA, there is more than an 80% chance a very strong El Niño will occur at the end of this year, which would rank among the largest El Niño events in the historical record going back to the 1950s, according to NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. While changes of 1 or 2 degrees in ocean temperature may not seem like a lot, they can be enough to affect fragile oceanic ecosystems. During prior Super El Niño years, 1982 to 83 and 1997 to 98 and 2015 to 2016, scientists chronicled mass coral bleaching and bottom-up cascading effects. Phytoplankton declines with the loss of colder, nutrient-rich waters, which lead to less food for fish and seabirds. Humans are also likely to experience dramatic El Niño-triggered events on land as the shifting ocean temperatures change typical atmospheric patterns. Increased droughts are expected off the western Pacific as more floods and hurricanes roil the eastern Pacific, but specifics are difficult to predict. Every El Niño is not the same, says Ken Graham, director of NOAA's National Weather Service. Each one is unique with its own imprint on our weather. And again, this particular article was by Story Hinckley, who's a staff writer at The Monitor. All right, now we're going to move over to the economy section of today's Monitor to pick up a headline. This one reads, "The U.S. lost jobs in July. Here's why unemployment didn't rise." One impact of Trump's immigration policies is showing up in the labor force, which faces an unusual period of stagnation. For now, unemployment can hold steady even when jobs decline. The date on this article is August 7th. It is by Laurent Belsey, who's a staff writer at The Monitor. It's a topsy-turvy labor market these days. In July, the economy lost jobs, but unemployment actually improved. Get used to the new dynamic, many analysts say. The workforce isn't growing by much. It might even be shrinking, partly because of a plunge in immigration. That means that the United States could create only a few jobs or even lose jobs in any given month, and the unemployment rate would remain stable. Net migration is very likely to be negative again for 2026, says Tara Watson, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of a January study that estimated that more migrants left the U.S. last year than came in. Zero or even negative job growth would not necessarily be a sign of a recessional situation. The U.S. lost 23,000 jobs last month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Friday. Economists have anticipated a gain of some 80,000 jobs, according to a Bloomberg survey. In fact, July set a dubious record. For 21 months in a row, the American labor force has been stuck at the 158 million mark. That's the longest streak at any one number in BLS records going back to 1939. A labor force that's not expanding could slow potential future economic growth. Many economists expect the job market to continue to grow, albeit at a slower pace. I'm not terribly concerned about July's job losses, says Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Most of them were concentrated among public school teachers who were ending the academic year. Joblessness actually improved. That's because at the same time jobs were disappearing, the labor force itself was shrinking by 264,000. That allowed the unemployment rate to fall to 4.1% in July, down from 4.2% in June. There is some concern that a big fall in prime-age employment for men in June was barely reversed in July, Mr. Baker says. The reason is unknown, but analysts have long known that growth in the workforce would slow as a big cohort of boomers retire. What's changed is immigration. These analysts had anticipated that growth in the numbers of migrants would offset that decline among the native-born. Now, however, the dramatic plunge in immigration under the Trump administration is changing the equation. Labor force growth has been slowing and could be near zero starting this year, Federal Reserve economist Seth Murray and Ivan Vidangos wrote in an April study. That's unprecedented in the United States' recent history. The January Brookings study estimated that somewhere between 10,000 and 295,000 more migrants left the U.S. last year than came in. If true, this net negative migration would be a first in the U.S. for at least half a century, the study said. Admittedly, the numbers are patchy. Unauthorized immigrants don't typically report when they come in or leave. The Trump administration has not published key data. Still, the evidence points to a dramatic slowdown, not only in the labor force, but also, quite possibly, in overall economic growth. With downward revisions in both May and June estimates, the BLS says the economy has been adding only 34,000 jobs each month over the past year. That's concerning. Two factors generally propel economic growth, an increase in the working population and productivity growth. But, quote, if labor force growth goes from 1% per year to 0%, we can expect economic growth to go from 3% to 2%, Stan Vuger, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, pointed out in a commentary last month. Over time, this adds up to a much smaller aggregate economy. One mitigating factor could be artificial intelligence. If AI dramatically increases the output per worker, then improved productivity could keep the U.S. on track for solid growth. I would anticipate some productivity upswing from AI, says Mr. Baker, but we're not seeing much evidence. And again, this particular article was written by Laurent Belsey, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to join me and listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with you with more from the Christian Science Monitor at the end of this week. Thank you for listening.